Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, today's show is all about bonds, the bond between human and animal, the bond between mother and daughter, and the bonds between strangers that come together and fulfill a collective vision. My guests today are each making a wonderful contribution to the world, following their own chosen paths. My first guest is Joe Camp. He created a big screen icon over 30 years ago and continues to write, to create, to walk his own path through life. And in fact, he says it's the only way to live. Coming up at 12:30, we'll talk with Susan Shapiro-Barash, gender and relationship expert. She wants women to take back their power this coming Mother's Day. She's the author of You're Grounded Forever. But first, let's go shopping. And we'll end today's show with the founder of Spirit in Action and author of Collective Visioning, How Groups Can Work Together for a Just and Sustainable Future. Her name is Linda Stout, and she's actually here in Seattle over the next couple of days, and we'll share more about that later on in the show. But first, I'm absolutely thrilled to welcome Joe Camp to the show. He created, wrote, produced, and even distributed one of my absolute favorite movies from childhood, the canine superstar Benji. Remember the cute little stray dog who rescued two kidnapped children? Well, Joe Camp has written numerous books since then, including Benji, The Benji Method, a dog training book, Who Needs Hollywood, The Soul of a Horse, Life Lessons from the Herd, and The Soul of a Horse, The Journey Continues. He's a passionate speaker and an intense advocate for the rights of children and animals, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to the show today. Joe Camp, welcome.
Thank you, Vicki. It's my pleasure.
Well, I must say, I just loved going through all of your books and videos and listening to some of the interviews where you've told some of your stories. You have some really fascinating stories, Joe. I guess we have to start really with Benji. This started years ago, as I said, 30-some years ago for you. But it's such an integral part of what you really represent about walking your own path and living life on your own terms and following your passion, because you were rejected by Hollywood. You were even ridiculed by many in Hollywood. So tell us a little bit about where you came up with the idea for the story for Benji and why it was so important to you to get that story told.
Well, it all began one night, actually, way, way, way back, watching, you know, one of those old Disney shows on Sunday night, and they had a clip from Lady and the Tramp on there, and that was one of my favorite as a kid.
Mm.
And so my wife and I wound up in the kitchen doing the dishes, talking about whether or not it would be possible to really do a movie from the dog's point of view and the people being the props, which is usually the other way around in a like a Lassie movie or something. All those old movies, is, you know, your heart was with the kid who's, you know, have to get rid of the dog because he's
right.
Eating chickens or something. And this was to be a story told like Lady and the Tramp, but with the real dog and not with, you know, somebody voiceover saying, and now Benji thinking, and not, of course, in those days there was no such thing as animating dog lips to let them talk or anything. So we finally talked it into the corner and said, if you can't talk, how in the world are you going to tell a story? And that night I stayed up reading a book, and our dog, which was a little Yorkshire Terrier whose name was Benji, was staying up with me, and I got to watching the way this dog reacted to a siren down the street or a dog barking next door or whatever, and so I kind of jumped into it and got down on the floor and started acting really stupid, and this dog is looking at me like, what is the matter with you? And I could tell. I mean, I knew that's what he was thinking, and so I went to bed that night with the concept that, you know, if you're really up there and paying attention, you do have dialogue in those eyes and in the responses that they give to things, and that's where the whole idea came from and nurtured out. And it, you know, I was living inside this dog for writing the story, and then ultimately, a few years later, doing the movie and so forth. And you know, it became very important that you know we knew when we were through that we had a movie that people would respond to, because you're really going through the experience with the dog and understanding every emotion that this dog is having. Because it, I mean, the thing at the time, a lot of the press was saying, you know, Benji's a better actor than humans around it. And so, you know, we actually put him up for an Academy Award for acting. He didn't get it, but it was a lot of fun. But, you know, when we first went out to Hollywood with the finished movie, because we produced it independently with funds that we raised ourselves in Dallas. And, you know, as you said, we were turned down and laughed at and ridiculed and so forth, and really had to figure it out ourselves. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you mentioned passion, because that's what I tell all the young people today, is really, really, really try to figure out where your passions are and follow them. My dad gave me some advice when I was, I think, a junior in high school, and I was beginning to wonder, what in the world, how do you know where you want to go and what you want to study in college, and that sort of thing. And he said, do what you would do if you didn't have to make any money at it whatsoever, and you'll always be happy in your work, and you'll always do your best job. And I think that what drives that is the passion. And I think the only way we ever got through this Benji process, with all the slam doors and all the rejection that we took on the thing, was that the passion was so strong that it helped carry you over the walls or under the walls or around the walls or the slam doors that are, you know, thrown in your face. And so that's kind of automatically what I've done for my entire life, is, you know, follow that passion, and knowing that it's always going to work because it's founded in, you know, in good spirit and good cause.
And I think, you have to live with a project like that 24/7, and you need that passion to carry you through.
True.
Because no matter how much you love a topic or a project, it can, you know, when you're living with it to that extent, you've got to have that passion to drive you. And you really do believe that if you work hard enough and have faith in yourself, you can pretty much accomplish anything, don't you?
I do. I really do, because we've done some pretty wild and crazy things, and I think it all goes right back to that concept of passion. You know, that's how Benji got started. That's how this whole horse thing got started. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's you know, we were just a very few short years ago had no clue. You know, we were total neophytes, and we didn't have a horse, nor did we have a clue about what you would do with them, how do you keep them, how do you do all of this. And three or four years later, you know, we're running with, you know, all the top trainers and horse people, and
yeah,
and have a best-selling book.
I read all this began for you when your wife bought you a trail ride for your birthday.
Right. Yeah. Right. We had bought a piece of property out in San Diego County. It's the last sticks left in, I think, you know, San Diego County or in Southern California. And it happened to have a couple of stalls on it, horse stalls on this property. And we'd sit out on the front porch and look out, watch the sun set in the west and whatnot over these stalls. And we'd always say, well, wouldn't it be nice if we had a couple of horses down there just walking around, and, you know, kind of like a picture postcard.
Right.
Sunset. And so we talked about that. So, well, we ought to go on a trail ride sometime and, you know, just see what the affinity is for these beasts. And so I got up one morning, and it happened to be my birthday, and she said, get in the car. And I said, what? I mean, I knew there was something up, obviously. But she took me down to this park down at the foot of the little mountain that we lived on, and there was a horse trailer with three horses all saddled up, and the lady that had come, and that's what she bought me, a six-hour trail ride for my birthday. And literally 3 weeks later, we owned three horses.
Wow.
I can promise you that, you know, a trail ride and owning a couple of stalls is not a good reason for buying three horses.
Right.
It started us off on a bizarre journey, for sure.
Big journey, a great journey. And I actually heard your wife say that she doesn't allow you to go out anymore with any empty stalls in a trailer because you're going to come back with another horse if you do.
That is very definitely the truth. We have a rescue at the time. Of course, we're still living in San Diego County, but we have a rescue that's actually from Des Moines, and it's an American saddlebred. And we were up at they had sent that horse to Monty Roberts. He's one of one of Robert Redford's stimuluses for doing that movie,
the Horse Whisperer.
Horse Whisperer.
Yeah.
And he's a terrific. Thankfully. You know, he exists. He's written books and done DVDs, and that's where we started right. And in the interim, we finally ultimately got to meet him, and we were up there for two or three different occasions.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one time we were up there, and he had been sent this horse from the Rescue League in Des Moines to give it some behavior modification and use it in his demos so that it would be a better horse to adopt. And myself and my stepson just fell in love with it. Just, oh, my goodness. And so we called and moaned and groaned to Kathleen.
Your wife.
You know, on the cell phone of, you know, look at this poor horse's feet. It's terrible. It really needs, oh, come on. And so sure enough, we had taken two horses with us up there, and we had a three-horse stall. And so that's what she said. You're never leaving with an empty stall again. we did come home with Mouse, and she's quite a delight. She's all girl and a lot of fun. And she's four now. She was just a baby when we got her.
Right. Well, we need to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to ask you about your escape from, what did you call it? You called it Taxifornia, California. Taxifornia, or escape from Taxifornia. Because that was a journey in itself. And we'll talk a little bit more about these two books that you've written titled The Soul of a Horse, because it's all about life's lessons and life's journey continuing. My guest in this segment is Joe Camp. He's, as we said, the creator of Benji, the dog movie, which was just such a favorite of mine when we were kids. And his books are called The Soul of a Horse, Life Lessons from the Herd, and his new book, The Soul of a Horse, The Journey Continued. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we'll be right back.
Next week on Conversations Live, we're Vicky St. Clair, serial entrepreneur and small business advocate Jen Gruber, creator of The Butler Bag and Launcher's Cafe, and author of the book, What If and Why Not, tells how to transform your fears into action by rethinking the negative questions that can stop you before you've started. Tune in Mondays at noon Pacific to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show archives.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Good news, Belgium. We're streamed worldwide at 1150kknw.com. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Joe Camp in this segment. He's the author of The Soul of a Horse. And Joe, give us your website, because there's so much information up there and loads of videos that people can watch about you talking about this subject, which I find quite fascinating.
It's thesoulofahorse.com. So the blog is thesoulofahorse.com/blog. And so both of those are... alive and well, and like you say, they're full of good information on the horse. Because one of the things that we found out as we were getting into this is that we didn't. we started doing a lot of research on what, how do you take care of these guys? What do you do? And I had done a Monty Roberts join up down in the round pen, and which gives, in a nutshell, the horse the choice to be in relationship with you, to trust you, and to allow you to be his leadership rather than taking and trying to dominate the horse. It gives him the choice. And when my horse, Cash, which is the cover boy on the book, came up behind me and touched me on the shoulder, in effect saying, I trust you.
Yeah.
To be my leader. I broke down crying and said, and I will be a good one if it kills me.
Oh.
And that's when I started the research of trying to figure out how do you take care of these guys. And what we found out, in a quick nutshell, is that most of the horses today being kept and cared for in a domestic situation are being cared for in a way that is diametrically opposite what their genetics are calling for.
Yeah, you don't believe in keeping horses in stables, do you? You believe
no,
that's...
A stall, unfortunately, and that's where a lot of them are, is the worst thing you can do for a horse that is, has evolved for 52 million years mm-hmm. in the Great Basin of the Western United States, and he has evolved to travel 8 to 15, 20 miles a day looking for food and water and staying away from predators and so forth, and to be out in the open. And you give a horse a choice, and he's going to be in, right in the middle of the biggest wide space he can find, so he can see predators coming from any direction, because a horse is a flight animal, a prey animal, and their biggest thing in life is security,
yeah,
safety.
Yeah. And I think people, if they haven't been around horses, they really don't understand the incredible bond that you can build with them. And, you know, a lot of people do come from this, you have to dominate a horse. But I remember when I had my horse, the farmer would always say, you can knock the devil into an animal, you have to build a relationship with him.
Right.
Yeah.
I you know, totally and completely agree. And that's what, you know, after we started with Cash that way, we all six of ours right now came back and got started the same way, and we have just an excellent relationship with all of them. They're all different. Every horse is, you know, that we have is just absolutely just like people. You know, they're totally and completely different, different personalities.
You also don't believe in shoeing horses.
Well, no. I mean, because what we found out, the more we dug and the deeper we dug, number one, I mean, what really turned me on to the entire, quote, call it what you were, the wild horse lifestyle, basically, is that we discovered that the hoof of a horse is supposed to flex with every step that he takes. It flexes out, think toilet plunger, like pushing down on a toilet plunger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it does. And when it does that, it is sucking an enormous amount of blood into that hoof capsule and mechanism. I mean, I used to think that the hoof was just one big wad of fingernail or something, you know, but it's a very intricate mess of stuff in their bones and vascular systems and all kinds of stuff that need nourishing and circulation. And when the horse steps down, it's like another heart. It sucks all this blood down into the hoof, and then when the foot leaves the ground, it pops back, you know, from the flex and shoots it back up the leg, which is taking an enormous amount of workload off the heart. A horse that is barefoot will have a 10% less lower heart rate on average than a horse that is wearing a metal shoe,
mm-hmm.
because the heart has to work that much harder to get the blood up and down the leg and so forth. And so when I read all of this and realized that, you know, when you put a metal shoe on the hoof, it cannot flex. It can't. And that's one of the reasons a lot of people say, well, when I take my shoes off a horse, you know, he's always sore. That's because his hoof now is unhealthy because it hasn't had the circulation it is supposed to have. And so when you remove that shoe, the circulation comes back, and it's kind of like when you cross your legs for too long,
yeah.
You know, and your foot goes to sleep, because when the blood circulation goes away, the nerve endings quit working.
Right.
And
right.
Then when you go to stand up, you say, whoa, what happened there? And that's what happens when you pull a metal shoe off of a horse, and you know, the hoof has not had that kind of circulation. So that's really where our whole thing started. And I'm saying, wait a minute, you know, I thought horses were born with shoes on. You know, I mean, basically, and so I got into the wild horse research.
And you, I know you left.
These guys out in the wild have rock solid hooves that, you know, you could drive a railroad spike with.
Yeah.
Because they're living right, they're out all the time, they are moving you know, anywhere from 10 to 20 miles a day, and they're, so they're keeping their own hooves in beautiful condition and going over any kind of rocky surface that you want to go over.
Right.
And so that's, you know,
well, they're living with nature. They're living with nature.
For about 3 years, they've been totally, you know, out 24/7. You know, they have the breezeway of the barn they can go into if they want to, if it's, you know, too hot or pouring down rain or cold or something. But and they go in there sometimes, and most of the time they don't. They want to be out.
Yeah. So I know, Joe, you moved from San Diego, which is almost like desert kind of country around where you lived. You move out to Tennessee where you had like 7 days of rain, I think, the first day you arrived there. This was a very scary process for you, for all you'd been through over the years. To make this kind of move, what made you move that, and what kept you going through that process?
Well, that where we were in San Diego County is very much like the kind of, I mean, it's like high desert terrain, hard and rocky, like the horse evolved in, and so they were basically taking care of their own feet. You know, we did a maintenance trim every 8 weeks or so, which was basically just a little rasping and rounding off and so forth, because the surface of the ground that they were on and the rocks kept those feet trimmed down like they're supposed to. The deal is that when Mother Nature knows that they're going to be moving as much as a wild horse is going to be moving, it's got to grow enough hoof to support that movement on that really nasty terrain. But when you get them over here in the wet and the mush and the grass and
Whole different ball game.
Yeah. And so you have to help them with the trimming and so forth, do what they would be doing for themselves if they were in the wild out in the Great Basin. And so it was a scary first year, but we got it all together, and then they saw more grass when they got off the horse trailer than they'd ever seen in their lives, because I know all of them except Mouse were probably, although we didn't have any of them, of course, since they were babies, but they were probably all Southern California horses.
Yeah.
They'd probably never seen any grass at all, so they had a big time.
Well, I want to ask you, because we're almost at the end of our segment, what you think, because your books are all about life lessons with the horses, how they help you with relationships, how they help you with life, how they help you, you know, keep things in perspective.
Right.
What do you think is the biggest lesson that you've learned from this experience?
Well, I think that, as I say, dealing with the horse from their end of the lead rope means being over there and saying, you know, what does this horse want to get out of this relationship, and how can I best do that? And we realized, of course, that, you know, our mothers have taught us that all, you know, from the time we were babies, that if you treat your human relationships the same way, in other words, don't go into every relationship saying what you want out of it, but go in from their side of the lead rope, so to speak. And so we've begun to apply that, and particularly in your close relationships, like your spouse and your kids. You know, and I changed the way that, you know, I deal with Kathleen, because, you know, you kind of get comfortable in these relationships, and so now you're over here saying, this is what I want to do today, and what you really ought to be doing is working it from her side of the lead rope. And
from your wife's side, yeah.
Yeah, and so that, you know, I think that's a huge one, and it applies to all of our animals and all of our human relationships, and, you know, and to life, and patience, I think, is the other thing, and that's something I've never had any of it. and to deal with people or horses this way takes patience. You have to be, you got to slow down and allow the relationship to evolve, not just jump in there and snatch it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, and we have a Mustang too, who is wild out of them. It came out of the wild, and we adopted from the BLM, and she had never had lead rope on her or anything, So that has taught me patience.
That is definitely, yeah, I was going to
say,
way beyond anything you expected, I'm sure. And I know we can find out more about you. There are a lot of videos out there where you're talking on various topics at thesoulofahorse.com. And your latest book, you've got two books out called The Soul of a Horse, Life Lessons from the Herd, and The Soul of a Horse, The Journey Continues. Live the moments, inspiring new stories and compelling new discoveries, all from horses. It's a really, they're really great reads. And Joe Camp, you're doing great work, and I thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Vicki. I appreciate it very much. And I hope you got the questions ask that you want.
I have hundreds of questions for you. I could talk to you all day, but we got to go.
All right. I enjoyed so much being here.
Well, thank you. And again, my guest, Joe Camp, you can find out more about him. Just type in Joe Camp. He pops up all over the place. The Soul of a Horse, Life Lessons from the Herd, and The Journey Continues. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Please stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking with Susan Shapiro Barash.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Made fresh each day for you. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. And as I said at the beginning of the hour, we are talking about bonds today. We talked about some of the bonds in the first segment with Joe Camp about human and animal bond. And now we're talking with Susan Shapiro Barash. She wants mothers to take back your power this Mother's Day. And she is a gender and relationship expert who's frequently featured in the media commenting on women's issues. Her new book is called You're Grounded Forever. But first, let's go shopping. Susan Shapiro Barash, welcome back.
Welcome to the show. Thank you for having me on. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm very good. And your book has a very tongue-in-cheek title, so tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, the title, excuse me, is, to me, a great message to mothers, which is that whether your daughter is 3 or 35, there are still these struggles, and that's why the forever is in there. You know, you're grounded forever. And that was the whole idea of the study, to talk to women all across the country with daughters of all different ages and to find out just how they felt about their mothering and why did so many of them tell me that they felt they were second-guessing every decision they made.
Amazing, isn't it? Because when we're little, we think our mothers have all the answers, and here they are. As we grow up, we realize they've been second-guessing everything.
Right. I just think that the daughters grow up so quickly, and mm-hmm. they're exposed to so much beyond the mother's influence. Mm-hmm. That's what's really changed it today.
Oh, and we've got mothers coming up next day. So one of the things we're going to talk about are, you know, how we can spend a good Mother's Day with our mother, because, you know, I've had friends who I don't have this issue. I do get on well with my mom, but I've had friends who just dread holidays like this because they feel they have to do something special for their mom, but they get tense around the lead up time to it. What kind of advice do you give to them?
Well, I think it's time to start communicating, to sit down and say to your mother or say to your daughter, hey, this isn't really going well. There's a lot of tension in these relationships, and yet we love each other. So we really need to talk about what is going on here. Why are you so angry, or why are you so disappointed, or why is there so much friction? And it's very hard for mothers to do. It's very hard for adult daughters to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the mother is the first and lasting model for her daughter in everything, in her work, in the way she mothers, the way she conducts her female friendships and her romantic life. So daughters are really watching their mothers for a very long time and expecting to get some guidance.
Yeah.
So another piece of advice I would have is that we have to remember, even when we're 25 or 30, our mothers really aren't our best friends. There's always this hierarchy.
Yeah, yeah, there is, because I am very close friends with my mother, but push comes to shove, she's going to have final say at some point.
That's it. It's not that, when you get to a certain age, of course, it's much more of a friendship. But the wisdom that you get from your mother is still there.
Yeah, yeah. I was looking at some of the research that you've done. 60% of mothers recall their own adolescence in trying to shield their daughters from the same kind of experience they've had. 70% of mothers say they haven't set enough limits with their daughters. Why is it so hard for mothers to say no to their daughters?
Well, in the last 20 years or so, our culture has changed so much, and it really affects the mother-daughter relationship. I interviewed a mother who had a 6-year-old daughter who wept because the mother didn't buy the right sneakers for her daughter. And the mother, of course, did somersaults, and so she returned the sneakers and got the right sneakers, the expensive designer sneakers. So if a 6-year-old daughter knows what to wear and she feels she'll be disenfranchised without that item, mm-hmm. Imagine what that's like for a mother. So this is reflected in how they feel that they're really not having final say, or that their voice isn't heard.
Yeah, and I know you specialize in women's issues, but I was actually with somebody yesterday who I could tell was very upset by a phone call she just received from her son, because she had kind of tried to meet him halfway on a situation, and that wasn't good enough. So it doesn't matter how old our kids get, there's still that element of guilt there that we're not meeting their expectations, isn't
there? Well, the idea, and this would apply to sons as well, the idea that you would shelter them. Remember when you read my statistic and you said that mothers say that they remember what it was like. Because life is so hard today and so complicated and so slick and fast-paced, mothers of sons and daughters actually are trying to mitigate circumstances, trying to really soften the blows. And the question is, are we hindering or helping by doing that?
Mm-hmm. If people have had a very rocky relationship along the way, and, I've got one friend in particular I'm thinking of right now who just acquiesces to everything. Yes, mother, no mother, three bags full mother. But yet she goes off and does a whole other thing instead of, probably what she should do is sit down and set some boundaries with her mom. Mm-hmm. Where do they begin that conversation to set boundaries that have never been there?
Well, that was one of the intentions in researching this and in writing the book, is that it's never too late. If you think you're pushed around by a 10-year-old daughter or a 20-year-old daughter or a 30-year-old daughter, or if you think your mother is really not hearing you and not paying attention to you as an individual, then the conversation has to occur.
Mm-hmm.
Because the feelings are both ways. If you're dissatisfied, probably the daughter is as well, or the mother is as well, whichever shoes you're wearing. And so it's never too late to say, I think we need to change the circumstances and to recognize each other for who we really are.
Yeah, and what if it's the other part? I mean, it takes two people to sit down and do that, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it? What if one person is not willing to meet you? Is there hope there?
There is hope, but sometimes you need what I would call an inciting incident, where perhaps a daughter really hasn't listened to her mother, and then her heart is broken and she's 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly she remembers her mother's divorce and a very unhappy romance afterward, or something like that. Or just the fact that her mother's kind of seen it all by virtue of how old she is and the life she's led. And then you go to your mother and you say, you know what, I really could learn from you. So sometimes it's something like that, very dramatic, that will alter the course. But the idea here is to never give up and to ask yourself as a mother, what kind of mother do you want to be? To an adult daughter, to a teenage daughter, to a young daughter. And for a daughter of a certain age, by the time she's 18 or 20, to think about what kind of daughter she wants to be and what she has learned from her mother.
Right, right. Well, we've got Mother's Day coming up next week. My mother's lucky because she gets two Mother's Day. She gets the English one with my siblings who live in England.
Right.
And then I do the American one with her because I never know when the English one is.
When is the English one? There's a different day?
Yeah, it's, I forget when it is now. I think it's just before Easter, I think, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was just before Easter because she always tells me, oh, it's Mother's Day today. And like,
that's
and
so
I'm thinking,
funny.
Did I forget?
Right.
But she knows and she, you know, she's quite happy to take 2 days. So what are some ideas that you have, Susan, for how we can share this in a different way and how we can both enjoy it?
Well, for daughters, it's just such, you know, from the point of view of a daughter, and by the time she's 12, she recognizes, you know, that she can take a little responsibility for this day. And even if she has to talk to her dad or an older sibling to facilitate it, the idea would be to consider the mother's favorite outing or favorite, you know, point of interest, excuse me, and to really look into that, to sort of make it happen. If your mother loves movies, old movies, you know, whatever it is that your mother really appreciates, if she loves flowers or, you know, it sounds so corny and so trite, but it's really the day where the mother is supposed to be appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
And while we might look at it as a very commercial day and or a very sort of Hallmark greeting card kind of day, it's all of that, but it's more because it's really a day when a mother, it's a day when a mother stands out for what she's done and how much energy she's given.
Yeah, and these days so many people live such a distance apart. What kind of suggestions do you give to them to make their moms feel really special?
When you're separated as you and your mother are?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, email certainly works. And one of those great, you know, greeting cards you can send via email. And then because we have cell phones, we can talk to anyone at any moment.
Mm-hmm.
And text and again, thinking of what's special for the mother. And if there is a rift in the relationship, perhaps it's a day to even have the guts to talk about it, to have the courage to have a conversation and say, I know that, you know, there's been this tension or mm-hmm. that we haven't agreed on this, but maybe we can fix it after all. So maybe it's a day where you really come full circle.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good day to broach that, I think. My mother and I went to, with my sister and her husband, went to the Scilly Isles a few years ago when I was over in England. And to me, it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. It is absolutely stunning. And the island that we were on is called St. Mary's. It's just off the southern coast of England. And there are no cars on there, no transportation's allowed except for golf carts. And we just had the most spectacular day. We flew out by helicopter. We spent the whole day there, and it was just really spectacular. And there's a big, huge flower grower over there, and they grow narcissi. Is that right? Yeah, narcissi and freesias, I think, and daffodils mm-hmm. sometimes too. But they ship out to all parts of Europe, and so England, and So I always order mum flowers from there because it brings that very special memory of that very special
day.
It's
so great to be that thoughtful and, you know, to really pinpoint it like that. Sometimes there is one daughter, if you have a sister, you said. Sometimes if there's more than one daughter or perhaps a few daughters and sons, one of these children will take charge just by virtue of the way the family plays out. In a way that the others don't. So clearly, you're very thoughtful. You get those flowers, and you spark that memory. but perhaps your sister doesn't do as much. Or I know in my own family, my oldest child. I have three children, and I know that my oldest child, my daughter, who's older, that she always takes charge of Mother's Day.
Mm.
She just does. You know, she gets it. She's a good gift buyer. She's good at thinking about it. But she also likes to punctuate the holidays. The real question, the salient question is, why isn't every day Mother's Day? And I would guess, based on my research for Your Grounded Forever, that mothers feel like it really is not.
Right.
That it's a far cry from mothers being honored.
Right, right.
On a daily basis or even close.
Well, I got to say, otherwise I'll get clobbered by my brother and sister, that they both participate very well.
Good. Okay, yes, get that on the record.
Let me get that on the record right now.
Right. And my other children might say, are you kidding? Just because Jenny gets there first doesn't mean she gets all the praise, so I understand.
Yeah.
But it is like that. You know, now we're talking about family systems. We're talking about sort of who does what in a family. And Mother's Day, just like birthdays and all the rest, really underscore that. It makes us think for a moment of family positioning in the family.
Yeah. And as you mentioned earlier, some people do see it as a commercial day, and it is a commercial day, but, you know, we don't have to spend a great deal of money on it.
Not at all.
Just a simple doing something very special for that very special woman who's put up with us for all these years.
That's it. It's all about appreciation. And that's why... When I was interviewing recently, I was talking to a few mothers, and I said, how do you feel about Mother's Day? And they said, oh, the greatest gift would be if my teenage daughter would just listen to me, or if she wouldn't dress in those, you know, in those clothes that they dress in. You know, all the, so the frustrations of every day,
right?
They're not really, will they really disappear? I don't think that your 14-year-old daughter won't be influenced by her friends when it comes to how to dress on a Saturday, just because it's, you know, it's a few days after Mother's Day. I mean, we have to be realistic about it as well.
Right, right. I think that's a key thing in any relation. Keep it realistic. And your book is called You're Grounded Forever, But First Let's Go Shopping. And where can people find out more about you, Susan?
They can go to my website, SusanShapiroBarish.com, and they can get the book at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any bookstore.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you being with us today.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on.
My guest again, Susan Shapiro Barash, and her last name is Barash, in case you're wondering about that. Her book, again, called You're Grounded Forever, But First Let's Go Shopping. And we'll be right back. We're talking about bonds today, and we'll be talking about how a group can form a collective vision to make change in our world. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Intuitive dream coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at JoyceChapman.com, and if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email Joyce@JoyceChapman.com.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Clear, clean, and crisp. Check us out in digital quality sound on FM 98.9 HD3. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And I was just apologizing for the weather to our guests because we had such a fabulous weekend and it was such a disappointment to wake up to the rain this morning. But there you go. Linda Stout is my next guest. She's the founder and director of Spirit in Action. She previously led the Piedmont Peace Project in North Carolina, which won the National Grassroots Peace Award. She's the author of Bridging the Class Divide, and her new book is called Collective Visioning, How Groups Can Work Together for a Just and Sustainable Future. So, Linda Stout, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, this is a really appropriate subject today because we are talking about bonds today. And we're talking in this segment, of course, about collective visioning, how groups can come together, form a bond and make a difference in our world. But I want to just start with you are the founder and director of Spirit in Action. Tell us a little bit about that organization, how it came into fruition.
It came into fruition because out of a program that I did while I was the director of Peace Development Fund, and we interviewed and did focus groups all over the country for 2 years with activists and organizers about what would it take to build a movement that was broad-based, cross-issue, cross-class, race, and all the other ways we get divided, to build a really powerful movement that could really make transformative change in the world. And out of that, people came up with some significant areas that they felt needed to change in order for us to make change in the world. And so it's called Spirit in Action, changing the way we do change. And one of those was around we need to be able to talk about what we're for and understand what we're working for instead of always what we're against, especially if we want to bring in a large number of people. And we need to be able to learn how to work together, not just across race and class and typical divisions that we have, but also around a spirit of cooperation and supporting each other instead of competition and turf issues. And another area that they especially stressed was what I call spirit or heart, but it was talking about the values that we come into social change work from. All of us, for some people it's religious or spiritual values, but for a lot of people it's just deep-held human values and believing that there needs to be something really different, and how, as a very diverse group of people, do we bring our whole selves into that and be able to take action in a very different way than we've done, say, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, that really is in a way that's transformative and healing and allows us to be really successful for the long term.
Yeah, and you make a very good point there, Linda, yeah, that you are taking a different approach to the 60s mm-hmm. and the 70s, because we are living in very different times now. And,
of course,
we have to take a very different approach there. And I know the processes that you talk about in collective visioning in your new book are used by more than 120 organizations. I know from reading your bio that you grew up very poor. You were the 13th generation Quaker, born
right.
to a tenant farmer, farming family in the Appalachia region of North Carolina. You said you never thought that you'd be head of a national organization like this. What took you there?
I guess I sort of fell into it. I wanted to go to college, and I was the first in my extended family to ever graduate high school, and got a college scholarship, but had to drop out after 1 year, and started working in the textile mills, and later became a secretary, and had always wanted to work for change, and I think that was probably part of the Quaker training of knowing, you know, that there was a way that people could make change, even a very small group. And so I got involved in, like, the peace movement and the women's movement, which was big in the late 70s, early 80s, and felt very disenfranchised as a poor person, as a person who talked kind of funny, who wasn't well-educated, and by formal standards, wasn't well educated mm-hmm. because I now understand that school is not the only kind of education that you get.
Right, right.
And so I felt very often very shut down and voiceless in those situations and not considered a person who could be a leader. And I actually first met Septima Clark, who was called the grandmother, now called the grandmother of the Civil Rights Movement, who actually did training at Highlander Center for people like Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. So, and she was very elderly, and I was very young, and she mentored me. But I really wanted to organize poor people in my community and do multiracial organizing, which was unheard of in the rural South of where I lived. And that, from that very first experience, I realized that vision had to be a part of the work we did.
Right.
It didn't have to be this kind of woo-woo sit-down with vision, although I love that part too. But the first gathering, all the African-American people sat on one side of the room and all the white people sat on the other side of the room and felt they had nothing in common. And I was like, okay, how are we going to break through this? And I asked a simple question, like, you know, tell your name, what community you're from, and one hope that you have for the future for your children. And that's a form of visioning, and it developed into doing 25-year visioning exercises. But visioning was only the first step because, as one of the kids that I've worked with in New Orleans said, it's all just pretend. And I said, you're right, it is pretend unless you figure out a roadmap of how to get to that vision.
Right.
And it's a collective process to do that because we all aren't holding all the skills of a leader. We have to put all the pieces together.
Right. Now,
I think that's really critical.
Yes, absolutely critical. And I know that many grassroots foundations, they fail before they even get off the ground.
Oh, absolutely.
We're almost at the end of our segment, but very quickly, what if you were to give a grassroots foundation, you know, the one key tip to get started and keep moving forward, what would that be?
I always call it going slow to go fast. It's really taking the time to build trust and relationships, and getting to really know each other, and then the work can move much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, doing a visioning process that you know what you're working on collaboratively. And we always insist on bringing a broad-based group of people together, and I talk about how to do that in my book.
Yeah, it's one of the only books I've really seen on this. It's called Collective Visioning, How Groups Can Work Together for a Just and Sustainable Future. And for anybody thinking of putting a grassroots effort together, this is a great guide for you. Now, very quickly, because we've only got a minute left here, Linda, but I know you're in Seattle today and tomorrow. Do you have dates and times of where you're appearing?
Yes. Well, we're actually doing a joint fundraiser with Social Justice Fund tonight at Cafe Flora at 7 o'clock. And for people who want to support the work and support the work of Social Justice Fund Northwest that funds grassroots organizations in this region of the country. And so I'm using my book to collaboratively help others.
Okay.
Other organizations. And then we'll be doing a reading at Elliott Bay Bookstore in Seattle tomorrow night, Tuesday night at 7 p.m.
Awesome. And if people want to find out more about your work at Spirit in Action, where can they find that?
Well, if they go to my website, lindastout.org, then they will find connections to both Spirit in Action and Building Powerful Networks, our training program.
Awesome. Well, I thank you for being with us today. I hope your fundraising goes well and your talk at Elliott Bay Books. And thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And my guest,
I appreciate that.
Sure. My guest, Linda Stout, her book again, Collective Visioning, How Groups Can Work Together for a Just and Sustainable Future. And you can just Google her and find out more at her website if you have any questions. I want to thank you for being with us today. Appreciate your time and spending this hour with us. You can follow us and talk to us at Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. And You can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, and you can email me at info@conversationslive.net. Conversations is plural. Thanks for being with us. Live well, live strong. See you next week.